The following podcast is brought to you by The Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
So good morning and welcome. This is June. And June is a busy month. Especially for Geminis. And that's such a gift, isn't it, to stop all our doings and bathe in non-doing, in silence. In the connecting to our own hearts, our own minds, our own being. And from that connection, experiencing the wholeness, our part, our wholeness. Even if we don't always feel that way, even if our physiological states would try to persuade us otherwise, that wholeness is a given. And that's what we do. At times we need to be reminded, we need to remember. This fact. A hair's breadth deviation and heaven and earth are separated. It's easy for us to lose contact, to lose our connection. Our connection with our own hearts. And with that, the wholeness. So, this month, the big experience for me that brought this up front and center was when a bunch of us had the extraordinary opportunity to go to Montgomery, Alabama, and visit the Slavery Museum. Well, to bear witness, really, to the unspeakable cruelty generated by bigotry in this country, starting with the domestic slave trade, continuing through apartheid, and, as we still see, continuing through the mass incarceration of African-American population. And so our group saw the warehouses where African-American men and women were separated from their children, stripped naked, to be auctioned off to the highest bidder. And they had to speak of their skills, their capacities. They had to sell themselves, and if they didn't speak highly enough of how fast they could run or how much they could work, they were beaten. after Reconstruction, lynching was carried out systematically for decades for the most minor infractions. Asking a white person for a glass of water, a crime. Organizing a community to vote, another crime worthy of lynching. Or complaining when a white person refused to serve him. So, over the hours and days as our group was taking in the cataloging of this systematized terror and the orchestration of such humanity on such a scale, I found myself being overcome. It was horror, but also bewilderment, the sense of bewilderment. How is this possible? And I did find myself going up into my head asking questions like, well, so how could a black person ever relate to a white person again? Or how do the African-Americans who are also here, how did they manage to contain their rage, their desire for revenge, reparations? How is that possible? Seeing the machinery of such savagery laid bare, how do we countenance it? So I had questions that I didn't know what to do with them. Of course, our group sat in silence, silent witnessing. And then by chance, I saw a couple who were there, a mixed race couple, two women, white woman, probably in her 40s. And the African-American woman was older. And so they were sitting together before a particular sculpture when I passed, and tears streaming down their faces. And yet they were chanting. They were singing a hymn. And later, when we got outside, I saw them again and felt compelled to go talk to them and see. I needed to talk about this. What was their experience? How did they relate to this? And I instantly found talking to them was like drinking a refreshing glass of water. Their perspective and how they talked about it, the language they used, it restored me. And so they saw the memorial, they said, as a way to sensitize our hearts, as an opportunity to lament. To grieve the the dehumanization caused by, as they said, these broken connections. And they talked in terms of, like, turned out they were both reverends. They were interfaith ministers. So they talked in terms of the Holy Family and everyone being part irremediably of this Holy Family. And the white woman said, she said, for her to reclaim her space in this Holy Family, she had to acknowledge that it was her kin who did the lynching. And not just the ones who fought in the Civil War, but the ones who lynched their brothers. And so, and I said, but what about, you know, those who aren't ready to see it that way, who can't acknowledge this history in this way? What about them? And the response was, connection is an innate longing in everyone. Wherever you stand, they said, you're connected to something, to someone. And that they thought that people were afraid to feel. They're afraid to allow themselves to feel. And rather than allow themselves feel, they built walls. Walls in their heart that created this illusion of separation. And so the hymn they were singing "You are the face of God, I hold you in my heart. You are a part of me, you are my family." So this is what they sang over and over again as they witnessed the barbarity. And basically they were saying, what allows crimes against humanity are the crimes in our own heart, against our own hearts, which hardens, our heart hardens, so that we're no longer able to grieve. So, interestingly, there is a koan that we've been studying in our PATH class that I think speaks to just what these women were saying. And it draws on an 8th century Chinese folk story. It's called Senjo is Separated from Her Soul. And I think you'll see how it also deals with this inability to grieve. And the consequences, which even as far back as the 8th century, people were able to somehow witness. So here's the story. Once in a village by a river, a boy and a girl, second cousins, grew up together as inseparable companions. They were so close that the girl's father once joked that they seemed married already. And eventually they did fall in love. However, one day the girl's father announced that she was to marry a different man. The girl Sanjo and her sweetheart Ochu were devastated. And Ochu was so upset that he decided to take his boat and leave the village. Just as he began to sail down the river, he saw a shadowy figure standing by the riverbank. Sanjo stepped into the boat and they escaped down the river together. 5 years passed. They had 2 children, were very happy. Except from time to time, Sanjo would say she missed her father and wanted to go back and visit him. So they decided to return, and when they arrived home, Ochu went up to Sanju's house and asked the father forgiveness for leaving with her. Her father seemed surprised, and he said, "What? From the day you left, my Sanjo has been upstairs lying on her bed, sick, and not speaking a word." Just then, Sanjo from the boat arrived at the door, and suddenly Sanjo from upstairs appeared, smiling. The two Sanjos looked at one another and walked right into one another. Instantly, they became one. So, the koan asks, "Sanjo and her soul are separated. Which is the true one? The one who married Ochu, who sailed away, or the one who stayed with her family and lay sick in bed? Which one is the true one?" So we could ask, or we do ask, don't we, the same question with, which is the real one, the Nazi officer or the loving family man? The Catholic parish priest or the pedophile who preys on children? The genius movie producer or the one who sexually assaults women? Which is the true one? The enlightened Zen master or the master manipulator? Which one is the true one? The founder of the Constitution or slave owner? Which one is the true one? So the poem goes, "Ever the same moon among the clouds. Different from each other, the mountain and the valley. How wonderful, how blessed is this one or two?" So, what is the teaching? That nothing, even our worst sins, can deprive us of our belonging. But the question remains, doesn't it, is how do we lose that sense? How do we lose that connection to the whole, to our own hearts, that allows us to act in ways that are counter to our best selves. So we have self at worst and we have self at best. Two or one? So I think one of the things that are coming to light that are helping us to understand when we are self at worst are the neurobiological findings around trauma and how we need to understand what happens when trauma has occurred, what happens to the nervous system. And by trauma, I mean experiences that are overwhelming, beyond our capacity, our tolerance to manage. So typically, you know, the child is helped to regulate their feelings or to regulate when something happens that is frightening or, you know, upsetting. And because their nervous system is still developing, they need the co-regulation of another who can help them brush off the knee, cry, and come back to a position where they feel restored and resilient. And we see this with animals. You know, ducks can be seen to get into a tussle with one another. They'll, you know, go at it. And what they do after that is they'll just fluff out all their feathers. And they're back to smooth sailing. So that's how birds do it, animals will do it too, they'll go off and they'll shake. When we encounter, though, an experience that is beyond our capacity to integrate, that is to be able to have our feelings, whatever they be, the system takes over and we can move into patterns to protect us that are hardwired for survival. So, all right, so with Senjo, she gets the news from her father, who is, you know, supposedly her protector, the one who loves her, that regardless of her wishes, he has made a unilateral decision, and she has no say in the matter. And so we can understand her devastation, can't we? She's in one fell swoop, she's lost her connection to her lover. She's lost a connection to her idea of a loving father who cares about her, who is attuned to her desires, wishes, needs. But because she's unable to either reason with him or cry or grieve, what happens? She goes into shutdown. And there's a complete collapse. Which is an accurate description of the most primitive of our autonomic nervous system patterns, called the dorsal vagal, where the threat is seen as so extreme that it's instantaneous. These are not conscious decisions. It's like the organism is reacting out of protection, and it shuts down to conserve energy. It's what invertebrates do. They play dead, play possum. So in that state, person's not able to communicate. Is not able to connect to themselves. There's a quality of dissociation, of leaving the body. And this, again, can be a protective function in times of danger and in times of pain. The problem is that it keeps us isolated, cut off from connection. And so nothing changes. So that's one Senjo who stays collapsed in bed. And this is a place where one can feel a sense of despair and hopelessness. Just on that note of, you know, parents doing things or making decisions for your own good, there was a book written by Alice Miller, Swiss psychoanalyst, by that same title, For Your Own Good. And she believes that her claim is that it was what she called the poisonous pedagogy of the upbringing, Germans, how they brought their children up before World War II. The sense of complete sort of children having to submit to the parents' authoritarianism. And this, she feels, set the way, paved the stage for Germans being able to collaborate with Hitler in the extermination of the Jews. So if we look at then the character Senjo, the next stage in this autonomic response is one of flight. And that's a newer one because we're mobilized to do something, fight or flight. But again, we see that in her leaving, she's protecting herself. She's doing what she feels is in her own best interests. But it's at the cost of the rupture, isn't it, with the father? She's broken that connection. And then we come to the last stage of the autonomic nervous system response, where she misses the connection to her father and wants to reach out, wants to reconnect. And this is where we would see where in the wanting to connect, the heart comes back online. She seems to have forgiven him. And so she does make the journey back, and all is well again. But the reason I'm talking about this is that think it allows us to have compassion for again, that self that acts self at worst, when we lash out, when we're impatient, when we're judgmental, when we're unthinking, all of the ways where we are not actually attuned to either ourselves or the other. And I don't need to multiply the examples because I'm sure, you know, you all can come up with them. And the thing is that we, in that, when we can become very harsh and judgmental towards ourselves for failing to live up to what we know to be our best selves and what all the spiritual teachings talk to about how we should be. And yet when we understand that these responses, it's sort of like this is what we share with all animals. It's the biological substrate of our experience, and it operates beneath our awareness. So it doesn't think in terms of good or bad. It thinks in terms of safety, protection, threat. So let's say you're walking in the forest and you come across a dog, maybe next to a tree. He's tied next to a tree, and you might go over and say hello to the dog and reach to pet him. And he bares his fangs and growls. And you kind of step back and even might get a little angry. What, you know, what's going on here? And then you might notice his paw stuck in a trap. And it becomes, oh, you poor thing, you're suffering, you're in pain. So that for someone who's in pain, for someone who's in for someone who's experienced trauma, who has been injured, what's real are their perceptions of reality, not reality. So for the dog with the paw stuck in the trap, you are a threat. It doesn't matter that you have a soothing voice and that you're reaching over to stroke this person. You represent a risk and a threat. And so it's only its only protection is to protect itself. So, to bring it back to our own selves and how we can practice with this information. Here we are in a room where I think we should feel pretty safe. I hope everybody feels pretty safe and comfortable, where, you know, the temperature is regulated. Later, if we get hungry, we're going to be fed. People have prepared food. If we're uncomfortable in our posture, you know, we can shift our posture and find something. There's no one here who has it in for us, let's say. And yet, what I'd like us to do is just notice our own thoughts, even though this is perfectly safe. Just notice in the stories you see that come up. About myself, where I might, where the focus might be. For some of us, it might be, well, I don't belong. I don't get to sit at the table. I'm excluded. And just see in our stories how we might be reinforcing that state of disconnection, that state of being outside, not invited in, not belonging. And just to feel how that affects us. You might see in our posture, we might get into more of a sort of a collapsed place where there's a lack of support. Another style might be kind of, I'm ready. I'm going to defend myself. And I might be more easily sort of prone to anger. And I might be noticing and being sort of very vigilant about how I might be in danger, especially if I have a service position. I'm going to make doubly sure I'm not going to fuck up. I'm going to rehearse in my mind a million times what I need to do next. Look at my notes. Because God forbid I make a mistake. And so I'm going to be super, super on top of that. And so that just gives us a sense of how I organize my safety. I have to make sure that I'm not going to be exposed. I was talking to a man this week, 55-year-old man, who had the realization that very accomplished, that his endless doing and his endless caretaking, what was really driving it was this little boy, the age of 6 or 7, who was sent to boarding school and sitting on his bed, completely, completely terrified, and just wondering how he was going to get through. And how he got through was he jumped through every hoop that they offered him, and he jumped through it with stars. He did everything perfectly. Except that at the age of 55, his wife wants to divorce him because she thinks he's a robot. And he is at the top of his profession, but his profession he finds utterly meaningless. And so what this man did was he just sat and the tears rolling down his face and held this young boy in his heart. And And so it's noticing the stories, but then see if you can connect to what's beneath the story. See if you can connect to the state. What's there? What's that like? Is it an agitation? Is it a fear? Is it a heaviness? Is it out of sorts? So that's just a way of bringing our own compassion to bear, not judging, because we often, when we feel bad, that's the first arrow, and the second arrow, I'm bad for feeling bad. So, and if you're feeling good all the way, wonderful, bask in that. Let your whole organism experience this sense of goodness, safety, belonging, wholeness, so that it will remember, so that it won't forget when the clouds come. At Wisdom House this summer in August, there'll be a retreat, and then also I'll be giving a workshop on more of how we work in this way, bringing compassion to our own experience, learning to track our own autonomic nervous system to see where it is that we find ourselves hanging out, and how to bring awareness and compassion to that. It's a way to, again, heal our hearts so that we can then be available to heal others. I'm going to end with a poem from Rilke, which is, I think, again, inviting us to explore and live fully, which is what we do when we feel safe. When we feel traumatized, as we can see with populations in this country, we do not like any kind of change. We can't take in newness. We want things the way we've always known them and keep them as they were. So here's Rilke's poem inviting us to feel the safety and be able to be fully ourselves, no matter what happens, to know that we're always held. God speaks to each of us as he makes us, then walks with us silently out of the night. These are the words we dimly hear. You, sent out beyond your recall, go to the limits of your longing. Embody me. Flare up like a flame and make big shadows I can move in. Let everything happen to you, beauty and terror. Just keep going. No feeling is final. Don't let yourself lose me. Nearby is the country they call life. You will know it by its seriousness. Give me your hand.